So I've selected to read a little book called The Singular Quality of an Ordinary Monk, which is about Lumpur Tian. So this is from the foreword by Bhikkhu Nirodho in Thailand in 1993. Lumpur Tian, 1911 through 1988, was his lifespan, was one of the most remarkable teachers of Buddhist practice to appear in Asia in modern times. His teaching issued very directly from his own experience, intensely personal and original, and in translating the talks collected here from Thai into English, we have attempted to achieve the highest fidelity to the original, preserving the talk's style, rhythm, verve, and profundity, together with their occasional peculiarities of expression. And then he goes on to talk about the various difficulties of translation. So I'm going to go on to the biography. A brief biography of Lumpur Tian Chittasubho, also known as Pan Intapyu, was born on September 5th, 1911 at Buhon Ampur Chengkan in province of Loi. He was the son of Jean and Som Intapyu. His father died when he was young. Since there was no school in the small village of Buhon, he did not have a formal education in his childhood. The boy, like the rest of them in the village, had to help his mother in running the farm. At the age of 11, he was ordained as a novice at the village monastery and stayed there with his uncle, who was a resident monk. During a year and 6 months in the monastery, he studied Laotian scripts and ancient local scripts. He also started practicing various meditation methods, such as the Budho and breath-counting methods. After disrobing, he returned to his home. Following tradition, he was ordained as a monk at the age of 20, and he studied and practiced meditation with his uncle for 6 months. After returning to lay life, he was married at 22 and had 3 sons. In his village, he was always a leader in Buddhist activities and was highly respected and chosen to be the head of the village on 3 different occasions. Despite heavy responsibilities, he continued his meditation practice. Later, he moved to Chengkan, a larger community where his sons could attend school. Being a merchant, he sailed his steamboat along the Mekong River between Chengkan, Nangkai, Vientiane, and even as far as Luang Prabang. He had opportunities to meet several meditation masters, and his enthusiasm in pursuing Dhamma continued to strengthen. Furthermore, he began to realize that many years of being good, making merit, and practicing the various methods of meditation had not liberated him from his anger. Finally, he determined to start searching for a way out. In 1957, when he was nearly 46, he left his home with the firm determination not to return unless he found the truth. He went to Wat Rongsimukdam, Thampol Panprao, Ampur Tambon in Nongkai province, Ampur Sri Chiang Mai at present, and practiced a simple form of bodily movement, except that he did not follow the recitation of the words ting ning, moving, stopping, like the others did. What he did was only being aware of the movements of the body and the mind. Within a couple of days, on the early morning of the 11th day of the waxing moon of the 8th month of 1957, his mind reached the end of suffering completely without traditional rituals or teachers. Later, he returned home. He taught his wife and relatives what he had learned for 2 years and 8 months as a lay teacher. Then he decided to re-enter monkhood in order to be in a better position to teach the people. The ordination was made on February 3, 1960. His teachings were spreading across the country as well as outside. He devoted his life to teaching the Dhamma despite his poor health. He was diagnosed to have stomach cancer, a malignant lymphoma, in 1982. In spite of his illness, he continued his work actively and incisively until the end of his life. He passed away on September 13th, calmly at the age of 77, in a hut in Loi Province. Lumpur Tian, The Singular Quality of an Ordinary Monk, by Vatana Sampramajak, M.D. If you had the chance to meet Lumpur Tian, you probably would have seen him as just another elderly monk who was calm and spoke little, very like other elderly monks that can be met in this country. But if you had given some attention to observing him, you would have noticed that along with his calmness, he was at all times very collected, alert, and aware of himself. When we had the chance to ask him about various problems, we experienced the uniqueness of this ordinary monk. A person who was nearly illiterate and who emphasized and taught the single subject of sati, sustained awareness of oneself, at all times. He exhibited very clear wisdom of the most penetrating kind in regard to our questions. His answers to all questions were remarkable to such an extent that we would label it incredible that a person without the formal education that we so value had the ability to answer and explain in a way that was at once so simple, clear, deeply meaningful, precise, and understandable, explanations capable of fully putting our doubts to rest. How we label or categorize Lumpur Tian is of no importance. What is important is his teaching. His answers, even to very simple and basic questions, are full of value, just like the lighting of a lamp in a dark place. They dispel the darkness. His answers will be of benefits to a greater or lesser extent to those who aspire and are in search, those who are lost in darkness, unknowing, doubtful, and not understanding. During the final 5 years of Lungpur Tian's life, I and my medical colleagues who were caring for him asked him questions from time to time in order to ease our own doubts. The following answers, teaching, and views have been gathered and recorded in order to make them available to those who might find them of use. There is no intention here to praise or to display a devotion to Lungpur Tian, nor to promote or create faith in him. It is the reader's responsibility to consider the following with deliberation and discrimination. Religion. Lumpur Tian said of religion that religion is the person. When we heard this, we failed to understand. Therefore, we asked him, is religion really the person or not? He answered as follows. Religion is merely a word that we use to label the teaching of a person by a person who is considered to understand the truth or nature of human life. Such teachings are various. If we speak of religion, it might give rise to doubts and arguments and disputes. Therefore, please allow me not to speak of this. If you want to know about the actuality, the true nature of our life, Dhamma, I will tell you. When you have understood, all your doubts about religion will disappear. 2. Why did he search for Dhamma? I once asked Lumpur Tian how it came about that he was inspired to search for Dhamma. He explained that he had strictly followed the traditional practices his whole life, had observed the moral precepts devoutly, made merit, and practiced generosity at every opportunity, offered katina robes each year. But on the last occasion that he had organized the katina offerings, a dispute concerning the merit-making arose between him and members of his family. I therefore, he continued, considered as follows. How was it that, having kept the precepts, made merit, and practiced generosity to the fullest, I could still have this suffering arise within my mind? In light of this, I decided that from that moment on to seek true Dhamma, that which would free me from the grasp of dukkha. Dhamma is not clothing. Lumpur Tian once told us that for a long time he had incorrectly believed that Dhamma was something outside our body, like clothing that had to be sought for and then put on and worn. But in actuality, Dhamma is already present within us right now. Referring to the study of Dhamma, Lumpur Tian said, to study the Dhamma merely for the purpose of discussion and debate is of little use. We have to apply it and use it and practice it to the fullest. Then it will yield its great benefit. The story of Venerable Ananda. I was always in doubt as to why the Venerable Ananda, in spite of listening to and hearing and knowing the teachings of the Buddha, more than anyone else, was not fully awakened to actual Dhamma. Lumpur Tian explained, Venerable Ananda knew a lot about the Buddha, that is true, but he did not yet know himself. After the Buddha passed away, Ananda studied to really know himself and therefore succeeded in attaining full awakening. Lumpur Tian teaches outside the texts. I once mentioned to Lumpur Tian that whereas people generally held strongly to the Tipitaka as the authoritative text when studying Buddhism, when he himself taught, he rarely ever mentioned the Tipitaka. Lumpur pointed out, the Buddha's teachings were recorded as recorded in the Tipitaka several hundred years after the Buddha passed away. And this text was thereafter copied and recopied over a period of thousands of years. The teachings were probably recorded very well, but it is possible to doubt that the reader will now understand what those who recorded the teachings meant. For me to refer merely to the texts all the time would be like guaranteeing the truth of the claims of another, claims of which I am not certain. But the things that I tell you, I am able to guarantee, because I speak from my own direct experience. The text is like a map. It is suitable for those who don't know the way to go, or have not yet arrived at the destination. For one who has arrived, the map no longer means anything. Another point about the Tipitaka is that it was written in the language used in a certain region of India and was consequently appropriate for the people from that area or for those who have learned to read that language. But Dhamma taught by the Buddha is not something that can be monopolized by anybody. It transcends language, race, gender, and era. If we really know Dhamma, we will teach it and express it in our own language. The study of the Tipitaka is good in itself, but don't attach to and get lost in the specific words used. Mangoes, for example, are referred to by different words in different languages. Don't fall into dispute over words and interpretations or become obsessed with the notion that only one word correctly names the fruit, meanwhile neglecting the mango and letting it go rotten. Anyone who eats a mango must know the actual taste of the fruit no matter what name it is given, or even if it is given no name at all. Deceived by thought. Longpo Tien said that we human beings are always thinking, just like the current of a river. Being lost in and deceived by thought is like scooping out water and storing it up. But if we really have sati, awareness, seeing thought immediately as it really is, it is like the water flowing freely by and passing by. Being lost in and deceived by thought gives rise to suffering. Someone once asked Longpo Tien to explain what suffering was. Longpo placed an object in his hand and then clenched his hand tightly, making a fist. He then turned the fist over and opened the hand. Indicating that the thing had dropped out of his hand to the ground, he pointed out, "This is suffering." The questioner understood immediately that suffering is a thing that we conceive of and assume and then seize hold of firmly, that it can be released. Longpo said that someone who can understand this quickly is one with wisdom. What is it like when the rope breaks? In reading Longpo Tien's account of experience practicing Dhamma, it is difficult to understand what is meant when, to describe the final stage of his practice, he uses the simile of it being as if a rope that had been stretched tightly between two posts suddenly broke in the middle and could never again be reattached. When questioned about it, Longpo elaborated, "Words are merely sounds that are used by convention to mean certain things, but the words that can explain the state you are asking about don't exist. If we are able to place a certain amount of white paint 1 centimeter away from a certain amount of similar amount of black paint and then mix them until they are thoroughly blended, we would name the color in the middle gray, wouldn't we? But if the white paint were placed 10 meters away from the black paint and then the two were gradually mixed until well blended, you will find that there are no words to explain the shade of color at any one point in such a way that another person would know exactly what that shade is. The color must be experienced directly. Have you ever looked at the rain clouds? They appear to be different shapes and forms. But if we are in an aircraft and fly into the clouds, we don't see them as we did before we entered. There are no words to explain the state you are asking about. It is beyond language. It's useless speculating or trying to imagine it, or thinking to oneself that it has to be like this or like that. You must know it for yourself. You must see it for yourself. You must experience it. Trivial problems. Longpo Tien once commented that many of the people who came to see him only asked about trivial problems, such as how much merit they would acquire by doing such and such, or whether it was true that they would be reborn to a new life after death, and so on. It was seldom that someone would ask what Buddhism really teaches and how that teaching was to be applied in practice, or would ask what was that needed to be done in order to reduce suffering. Longpo responded only to what he was asked. it would, he felt, have been inappropriate for him to raise and answer questions of substance himself. Reality and supposition. Lungpur Tien said that human beings are long-lived and think and remember much more than do animals. When they live together in large communities, it becomes necessary to establish rules and conventions for the sake of social harmony. As time passes, however, later generations come to regard these conventions that have been erected by the human mind as independent reality. When someone points out that, far from being reality, these things are actually shared suppositions, most people will refuse to see it. This refusal is very common. What is called money, for example, is actually paper, Lungpur remarked. When we try to use it, people accept it. People accepting it gives it its value. If people won't accept it, then it is no more than paper. In our current society, we use money as a means of exchange. Anyone who has no money will find it difficult to live. With money, we can buy convenience and comfort. But the extinction of dukkha is something no amount of money can buy. The practice of Dhamma. I once asked why Dhamma is taught and practiced differently in different centers, even though we all have the Buddha in common as our original teacher. Lungpur Tien replied, "This is quite normal. It is said that even in the Buddha's time, there were 108 different groups, each one claiming that its teaching was correct, and that the other 107 groups were following wrong views. We must use our intelligence and consider carefully for ourselves, to be either gullible or skeptical and of closed mind. Each is equally misguided. Any way of practice that leads to the extinguishing of dukkha is proper and correct. As far as the Dhamma itself is concerned, all who know its actuality will have the same perception." When someone asked whether various forms of Dhamma practice other than the one he taught were good or not, Lungpur answered, "Good for them, maybe not for us." Nibbana. Lungpur Tien told us of a conversation he had once had with a layman who, after an act of making merit, expressed the wish that his merit-making result in him entering Nibbana, the extinction of suffering, in the future. Lungpur asked, "When do you expect to arrive at Nibbana?" "After I have died," the villager replied. "Do you really want to get to Nibbana?" Lungpur inquired. "Yes, I really want to get there." Lungpur then said, "If that's the case, then you should die as soon as possible, and then you'll reach Nibbana very quickly." The villager was bewildered. "But I don't want to die yet." Since you want to go to Nibbana, why don't you want to die quickly? This shows that you have misunderstood." Lungpur pointed out to the villager, "The Buddha never taught people to go to Nibbana when they had already died, but he taught living people to reach Nibbana while still alive." Why did he ordain? Since apparently Lungpur Tien had understood Dhamma while he was still a layman, why had he ordained as a monk? The monkhood serves as the institution representing or symbolizing those who practice the Buddha's teachings well, the true Sangha, Lungpur explained. Being a monk makes it much easier to teach people about dukkha and its extinction. I once asked Lungpur Tien about the usefulness of sitting practicing concentration meditation. He replied that this kind of meditation was widely practiced before the time of the Buddha. It gives rise to a tranquil state of mind, but that is only temporary. When we emerge from the concentrated state, our mind is still subject to greed, anger, and delusion. It has not really changed. It is like placing a rock upon the grass. Even though the grass under the rock may wither, as soon as it is exposed to sunlight, the grass will grow again. This is different from insight meditation, which gives rise to knowing and understanding, to wisdom, so that the mind changes to a better state. Vasantara. We once asked about the case of Vasantara, who is held up as the very model of the perfection of generosity. Yet what he did seems to be an act of great irresponsibility towards his wife and children. Is it true that his act of giving them away led to him being reborn as the Buddha? Of course, Vasantara is the Jataka tale character who gives away his wife and children. Lungpur Tien answered, "The story of Vasantara is a story that has been passed down through many, many generations. If you think that it is true, then you should follow his example and give away your wife and children to the laborers or farmers in order to help them in their work. And thus you will perfect yourself and become a Buddha. But if I present to you the following comparison, that what you have with you now, what you are as bound to as to your wife or your child, are greed, anger, and delusion. Give them away. Relinquish them completely. Are you able to understand this? Believing. Lumpur Tien always said that we should neither believe nor disbelieve something immediately. We should consider and deliberate very carefully first to put it to the test, and then either believe it or not. Lumpur remarked that the history of the Buddha provides examples on this point. Angulimala was someone who believed too readily. He always followed his teacher's instructions, and even when in order to kill a great number of people, he did so. On the other hand, we have the case of the recluse Upaka, who was the first person to meet the Buddha after the Buddha's awakening. Even though Upaka recognized in the Buddha's characteristics that aroused trust and confidence, he was not willing to believe that the Buddha was someone who had awakened by himself. And so he went on his way and missed the opportunity to learn from the Buddha. Those who understand his teaching. We once asked Lungpur Tien about the number of people who, after hearing him teach Dhamma, or after having been instructed by him, could understand his teaching. Probably no more than 10 or 15%, Lungpur answered. This is quite normal. A person who is developed will be ready and able to understand. But most people interested in Buddhism are still firmly attached to customary practices, such as the making of merit. People protect morality or morality protects people? Lumpur Tien often asked, why do we observe moral precepts in a manner similar to taking care of a glass to prevent it from breaking? Why don't we live and practice to have morality that is, the mind that is normal, truly in our lives? Morality will then take care of us, rather than we having to worry about looking after morality. Merit. I asked Lumpur Tien, does making merit really give me merit? Lumpur Tien asked in turn, what do you understand merit to be? When I told him that I understood merit to be a good outcome or destiny that we receive after we die, in exchange for the good that we have done, he asked, have you ever heard the monks chant the list of benefits of making the Katina offering, that it will lead to us reaching heaven where the sprites numbering 500 or 1,000 beings will be our followers? Now consider the number of temples that are in Thailand. There is a Katina offering every year in every temple. Where could there be enough sprites to be found for everyone who had made merit? We imagine in this way that monks are like bank accountants responsible for calculating the interest owed to us after we die, don't we? I further inquired of Lumpur, if this is so, what is your view of making merit by giving material things, as is generally done nowadays? He answered as follows. Making merit by giving material things is good, but it is like husked rice, which is only of use for growing seedlings. If we are to benefit from eating rice, we must eat boiled or steamed rice, not uncooked or husked rice. To be attached to making merit by giving material things in a superstitious way is one form of delusion. To be lost in darkness, even if in this case it is a kind of white darkness. Merit at its highest, in its consummation, is to really know oneself, to be without dukkha. Monastic ranks. In the time of the Buddha, there were no such things as monastic ranks. Why, we asked Lumpur Tien, do we have so much of such ranks in modern Thailand? Is it a good thing or not? He answered, monastic rank is the creation and concern of society. You could call it either good or bad, whichever you want to, but we have to live in that society. Can studying Buddhism make someone a bad person? We once inquired why it was that some of the men who ordained as monks, studied to a high level, and subsequently left the monkhood, could later behave in evil ways, often worse than ordinary people who had never ordained and studied Buddhism. Lumpurtian answered, such a person studies only books, studies only theory, but never studies himself, so never knows himself. Bowing in respect to the yellow robe, I once mentioned to Lumpurtian that it is hard for us to know if a monk is really a true monk or merely a parasite upon the religion. We simply see someone with his head shaved and wearing the orange robe, and we immediately pay respect. Lumpur gave his point of view. If we bow in respect only to the orange robe itself, then when we pass through Sao Cheng Cha, where the whole of the long road is lined with shops selling monks' requisites, wouldn't we have to bow to each and every such shop, from one end of the robe to the other? Auspicious. Lungpur Tian told us how on one occasion, while leading the ceremonial chanting for auspiciousness in a villager's house, he had asked for a very large bowl to use in place of his alms bowl in the making of holy water, an integral part of the ceremony. When the chanting had been completed and the water in the bowl had been made into holy water, instead of sprinkling it over the people present, as is customarily done, Lungpur took the large bowl full of holy water and threw it all over the floor of the house, saying, everybody, please join together and help to put things in order, help to clean the floor. This is what is auspicious. Using holy water merely to sprinkle upon ourselves, we might suffer allergic reactions to the leaves floating in the water, break out in an itching rash, and have to waste money on buying medicines to treat ourselves. Now, how could something like that be auspicious? A monk bows to a layperson. Lungpur Tian related once how, when he was in Laos, he accepted an invitation from a villager to take part in a ceremony where traditional chants for extending a person's lifespan were to be performed for the villager's mother. But at the ceremony, Lungpur did not chant, so the sponsor did not offer him the usual requisites. Lungpur then explained to the villagers that to extend the lifespan of our parents, we must behave well towards them, not merely have the monks chant, and then hope that our parents will therefore live long lives. And he then led his children to bow to their parents for the first time, he himself setting the example. The villagers present at that time at once became very agitated, considering what Lungpur had done to be a violation of a tradition. They had never seen or heard of a monk bowing to lay people. Lungpur therefore explained to them, when I led the children to follow me in bowing to their parents to pay respect, I did not bow to the lay people at all. Rather, I bow to myself because I am capable of teaching people to understand the real way to actually prolong life. Spirit House. I once asked Lumpur Tian about the guardian spirit on the land of one's house, the land one's house is built on, who is considered to reside in the spirit house that we provide for it. I wanted to know, does the spirit really have supernatural powers such that it can either benefit or punish the person who owns the house? Just think, said Lungpur, if that guardian spirit really does have supernatural powers, why doesn't it just create a house for itself? Why doesn't it create its own food to eat? Why doesn't it have to wait for people to build a house for it and provide it food in supplication? And the food given to it is always such a tiny amount. Would the spirit ever be able to satisfy its hunger? Buddhist amulets. Before I knew who he was, I met Lungpur Tian at a time when I was very deeply interested in Buddhist amulets. With the purpose of requesting an amulet from him, I tried to impress him by showing him a very special and valuable amulet that I owned, boasting that my amulet was very ancient, having been made 700 years ago. What, he asked me, is this amulet made of? I told him that it was earthenware, made of baked clay that was extremely hard, and the fine brown color of tamarind paste that it contained in abundance of various minerals. Lungpur responded very calmly. Earth of all kinds originated at the same time as this planet came into being. Your amulet is actually no more ancient than the soil we trod upon before we entered this house. Just that one statement alone made me free to take the amulet from around my neck, relinquishing with the highest confidence my attachment to such things. When someone once asked if it was good to wear a Buddhist amulet around one's neck, Lungpur replied, it is good, but there's something much better than wearing an amulet. Would you like it? Lungpur was on one occasion asked by a man whether the amulet he owned really had supernatural, miraculous power widely attributed to it. Is its maker still alive? Lungpur asked the man. When informed that the amulet's maker was long dead, the amulet having been passed down as an inheritance, Lungpur commented, "Since even its maker himself has died, how can we hope that this thing will help us avoid death?" Ordaining and disrobing. I had to cut out almost the whole of Lungpur's Tien's stomach in order to remove the malignant tumor that was there. So I subsequently advised him that he should eat food in small quantities, but at frequent intervals. Lungpur said that to do so would involve eating at midday, which would constitute laxness in the discipline, and would invite gossip and censure. In such circumstances, he would prefer to disrobe, because it made no difference to him whether he was a monk or not. His mind was stable and would change no more. Do you know Lungpur Tien? Lungpur Tien related how on one day while he was at the Ramati Bodhi Hospital, waiting for a session of radiotherapy, a man seated nearby struck up a conversation with him, at an early point of which he asked Lungpur whether he was acquainted with Lungpur Tien. Lungpur replied, Well, yes, I know him somewhat. After they had discussed Dhamma for some time, the man became suspicious and asked, "You are Lungpur Tien, aren't you?" "Yes," Lungpur admitted. The concerns of the Buddha. We once discussed the nature of the relics of the Buddha, whether they were bone transformed to crystal or only burned bone. When asked for his opinion, Lungpur Tien remarked, "The concerns of the Buddha are not our concerns. Our concerns are not the Buddha's concerns. But the Buddha taught us that we should know all that concerns us. When you really know about yourself, whether the Buddha comes or not, is immaterial." The awakened individual. Lungpur Tien said, "As regards the body, there is no difference between the awakened individual and the ordinary person. It is only in regards to the mind, to the nature and quality of experience, that the awakened individual is better off and superior to the ordinary person, following the wishes of others." We once asked Lungpur Tien why, despite nowadays studying to high levels and having much knowledge, people cannot solve the problems of their own suffering. He replied, "Most people do what other people want. They don't follow the path of their own mind and heart, so things are as they are. The dead can be of little use." Lungpur Tien said that the study and practice of Dhamma needed to be pursued in this lifetime. We shouldn't wait until he died. After he has died, a person can do nothing for himself, and his words and examples can benefit others only a little. It is while we are still alive that we can truly benefit ourselves and others. Abstaining from eating meat. I once asked Lungpur Tien whether abstaining from eating meat would help one's practice of Dhamma. He replied, "If we are to practice or to know Dhamma, it doesn't depend on or concern what we eat or refrain from eating. Consider Prince Siddhartha. In attempting to realize Dhamma, he abstained not merely from eating meat. He refrained from eating rice and drinking water until he nearly died. Yet this brought him no closer to knowing Dhamma. Practicing and knowing Dhamma is a matter of wisdom." Attachment to meditation methods. Lungpur Tien once warned, attaching to a technique or to a method of practicing meditation, no matter what technique or method it might be, is like taking a boat to cross a river, and then, even though it has arrived on the opposite shore, refusing to leave the boat because of being still fascinated with the boat and its engine. Doing good, doing bad. I once mentioned to Lungpur Tien that some people doubt the truth of the old saying, "Do good and you'll receive good. Do bad and you'll receive bad." He pointed out, "It is society that stipulates what is to be regarded as good and bad. What is considered good in one place may be condemned in another. We should rather establish a new, more accurate understanding thus. Do good, it's good. Do bad, it's bad." Students. Lungpur Tien once classified people who had been educated into two groups and compared them as follows. In the first group are those who know clearly or really know. They are wise, and when they speak, one can understand immediately. The second group comprises those whose knowledge is a matter only of familiarity and memorizing. So when they speak, they will talk at great length and in a way that is evasive and extravagant, or else they will cite a text a great deal in order to induce others to believe them. This is because they don't really know the truth for themselves.
Okay. And for the meditation method that we were talking about just last night, I think.
Yeah, it was just last night.
I selected a book of it a week ago.
Uh-huh.
There's two of them out. But yeah. Is he the originator of that method of, or he must have learned that method from somebody else.
I'm not sure. I don't know the history of it, whether he just sort of experimented and found something that worked for him and has used that. I'm really not sure.
Mm. Wasn't there reference in there where he said something like he did the motion but didn't do the...
He didn't do the kind of reciting of moving and other...
Mm-hmm.
So maybe like a...
modified method.
Yeah, picked up. Yeah, something extrapolated or modified something that he had learned. Yeah.
Since he was going up and down the Mekong, there in the Laos area, do you know whether he ever had any contact with the Lumpur Chawan or that group of
that area? Really, especially from kind of Nong Khai, Vientiane, because it was mostly north, Chinkiang, mm-hmm. mostly north, Ajahn Chah is really a long way away. It may as well have been another country. Ajahn Mun would have been in the northern part of the Isan. Not a huge distance away, but you know, in those days travel wasn't that convenient, and especially imagine he kept pretty close to the Mekong, just the way that he was. Being a merchant, but there are. A couple other monks from that same province who are were disciples of Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Chah is one of them. Ajahn Bun something or other. I can't remember his name. Bun Ma, I think. But anyway, they were from Lui province and they ended up establishing monasteries in that province later. But it would have been around the time that say Ajahn Tien was actually reordained, as opposed to earlier when he was sort of really studying and looking.
I used to live in Chinkon.
Yes.
When I was 30. Yeah, I worked at the refugee camp.
Oh, really?
And it's very hard to get out of Chinkon. It's very small. Very beautiful across the Mekong. You know?
Right.
And I remember you have to take a bus only. Uh-huh. It's the only way to get out to Bangkok.
Right.
Yes. And there's one vendor that sells donuts. Local donuts, and we just love it because it's very hard to get anything from Bangkok.
You can't get anything at all, so.
It's a very beautiful town, and I would imagine it's pretty, even the time of Lumpur Tien would be very difficult.
Very remote.
Yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Oh, Chiang Khan. It's a very... even nowadays, it's still kind of remote area in Thailand. Because it's sort of that, as you go up the Mekong, that whole area is quite undeveloped. But I imagine naturally very, very beautiful.
And we rented a house, three stories.
Three stories?
Yes, the owner got into a car accident.
Uh-huh.
So there's three stories looking over the Mekong River. It's just beautiful. It's amazing. And we rented for 500 baht. Because the owner was killed by accident and they're afraid to live in that house.
Oh, people were afraid to live in that, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, so you got this big house for almost nothing.
Yes, and before I leave, they offered me to buy it, and I didn't want it. I thought it would have been a rich woman. And it's a good time of my life. Did you have it?
Yeah.
Isn't this important? Does he have any followers that are still alive and are disciples?
Yeah.
Like, does he have like a, are there a number of monasteries or?
Yeah, there's several branch monasteries. I mean, he had some students who continue, and I think, I mean, these days, I mean, his students are dying off. And he was getting into another generation. Some of his older students are getting on in their life. Around the area of like Chaiyapur, there's a couple very good, well-known. That's kind of north of where Ajahn Jayasaro is, but not quite as far north as where Ajahn Achalo is. But along that same mountain range, there's like a couple well-known monasteries that are affiliated with Gentia. I don't know, you know, that lineage very well or anything. I read, I think when I was on my sabbatical, there was a new translation of a disciple of Gentia. And Gina also came too, so yeah, it was very good.
In that translation, what's the name of that translation again?
Hmm?
What's the name of that book that you read in your sabbatical?
Can't remember.
Do you know the other one?
Hmm?
Do we still have it here, or do you know?
I'll bet we've got it here. Mm-hmm. I'll bet we've got it here.
Was it in English or Thai?
Yeah, no, it's translated into English. I think so.
Mm-hmm. We have one book. Actually, one book by one of his lay disciples, Kampong, the handicapped
man. That's, I mean, he's well known. This was a, it is a monk. They've got a branch monastery in Las Vegas.
So, Niroda, the person who did the translation, is that a Farang monk who you know?
He's a Farang monk who I've met. I don't know him very well. I meet a lot of people.
It's a great name.
Yes.
In the Lumpur Cha biography, there's a couple. And there's several cases in which he's kind of dragging a pakal along with him. And yes. I'm wondering who in, there seems the pakals were older, sort of like what was, you know, I mean, they're sort of Ajahn Chah's sidekick. We don't hear much about them. You know, sort of what is, what are they there for?
What are they there for?
Yeah, I mean, why did he become a pakal at 50?
Well, one is oftentimes, well, in Thailand, it's very, very, very rare that anybody would go by themselves anywhere. It's just Thai temperament. It doesn't matter if they're... I mean, Ajahn Mun, yeah, for parts of his time, he went off on his own, but, you know, for all the kind of perceptions we have, it's just very social, and then as a one of the things that a pakal can certainly do, I mean, in those days money was not a especially when Ajahn Chah, there was very very little actual money around, but still they could offer food, they could collect vegetables, they could, and because especially if you're a Northeasterner, which from the time you grow up you learn all the different vegetables and leaves and whatnot, both food as well as medicinal, so that a pakal or a novice could be collecting different things, and it's just as food is everywhere, so that having a, especially when you're on Tudong, really all you got was pretty much you got sticky rice, maybe got some chilies, maybe a banana. So if you wanted to have something to actually eat other than sticky rice, then pakals were very handy.
It is interesting, the social role of a person deciding to become a pakal at an advanced age. Is that more common than you would expect, or
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, in Northeast, I think it's more common than other places in Thailand.
Is it like a retirement option or something? Or a midlife crisis, retirement option? What does a person decide to...
Well, it's, you know, it's a whole variety of things. There's oftentimes, they might feel that they're, you know, they'd like to spend time in a monastery or to help out a monk, but they don't want to take a formal ordination. Also, there's a long tradition, actually, of like hermits that are pakals, as opposed to ordained monastics. So that's, but this is more in affiliation with monasteries or monks, and helping basically to either to helping a monk practicing alongside, being of service, but not wanting to take on the whole 10 yards.
Yeah, just being having been an elderly pakal myself, I can say that during that period of time, one has more opportunity actually to rub shoulders with people at the very top of the line than one does when one ordains. you're more likely to be taken on Tudong if you're a pakal.
By
someone who's accomplished, probably.
Yeah, that's quite true.
Yeah. How long, say, would somebody who was like 50 years old or something like that, as a pakal, how would that be a long-term thing? Would it be shorter term?
Okay. Yes. It's really, you know, it's not at all a fixed thing.
So Anagarika, it used to be Anagarika in Amaravati, I think, for 9 or 10 years, something like that. There was one Anagarika, I think it was.
Certainly Switzerland.
Switzerland. Yeah. I think there was a novice, 10-year novice at Amaravati. I don't think I've ever heard of an Anagarika.
Oh, Switzerland.
Switzerland, yeah.
So would Mongpa consider Rongpatien as a forest edition, or would be Tamayut, or I mean?
He's Mahanikai, but it's a forest. Because the forest tradition, you know, it's really quite varied. In the West. Well, even for your, yes, for yourself, I mean, even that you're asking, but the there's just so many different teachers and lineages and ways of practice. There's a real spectrum. Okay.